CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
You're like, that would have been the YouTube, the internet comments, almost all of them.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It's the director and co-writer of a movie called Every Last One of Them, Christian Sesma. The movie comes out in theaters on demand and digital on October 22nd. Christian, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what was the inspiration for your story?
It was this script came across to me from my producing partner, Mike Hatton, and the sales guys over and the producers over at 101 Films in the UK. And when I got the script, it was a very different. It was a different title, different a lot of things. But I felt it had like the really great bones to be something special if I was allowed to kind of go off on this daughter storyline and really just rework it. And they were totally supportive and really creatively allowed me to do what I wanted to do. And you know, I was like, look, I'm a giant Taylor Sheridan fan, Wind River, this, that, and the other. So I tried to kind of take this standard, you know, Rambo First Blood shoot 'em up and kind of infuse this really deeper layered storyline about really failed fatherhood, which is what I think is the core of this movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you have a variety of characters here who are all kind of, you know, they're kind of bad guys, but even your hero doesn't come out of this completely clean. Is that sort of what you were going for?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think this one, we are trying to ground it and really just make it that, you know, there's really, I think it's in life, it's very, you know, the heroes and the villains and those lines get pretty blurred most of the time. And it's really interesting to kind of explore that. And like I've said before, you know, Paul Sloan's character, Jake, and Paul did an amazing job in this. And that was the idea, is to kind of give him something to shine here that I knew he would, but really just give his character something to really deal with. But really it's this whole movie is of Jake's own making.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And it's some of those things, those themes that we go through life and we go, man, we didn't know that these decisions would have these consequences, but they do.
Yeah. He is, you mentioned the failed fatherhood and everything. And many times throughout this movie, especially the Richard Dreyfuss character, talks about how this guy goes out and he is the guy who protects other people, but he has somehow failed with his daughter. Could you give some background on your main character, who is Jake Hunter?
Yeah. So, I mean, Jake is that. I mean, I think he's an everyman. I mean, he's a, you know, the typical special forces character in these kind of movies. But what I wanted to kind of really dig deeper storyline wise is, you know, I'm a father and, you know, I have two girls and, you know, my cinematographer, who is like, he's a father. We always talk about what it is to be in this business as parents. And I think it's military. It's very similar. You go off, you spend time away from the family. You're trying to figure it out as you go and these kind of things. And so with this character, Jake, we really try to mine for that and really make that his core storyline, as opposed to what was originally, is like, you know, he's out, he's doing these missions, he's doing that, but very much like Jeremy Renner's character in Hurt Locker, you kind of are about that life. You need that life, and you put a lot of things on the back burner. And in this case, Jake Hunter, he put his family on the back burner, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, it's not even conscious, you know, you just go through it and you're trying.
Right. There's even a moment where it seems like he's doing what I mean, what in his head is the right thing in a flashback when he leaves the care of his daughter to his brother, played by Michael Madsen. And it's interesting, when he comes over and he apparently hasn't talked to his brother for a really long time.
Yeah. Brother in arms. Yeah.
Yeah. And he hasn't talked to him for a really long time, and he drops his daughter off basically, and like almost immediately leaves after just a couple of conversations. And it seems like the right thing. This guy's been through, you know, drug abuse. Right.
And I know it's like when I did that. And again, this was all not in the script. I mean, we were very much riffing and playing jazz as we went with this stuff, with when it comes to really like the daughter storyline was not central to this movie. And it really at all. I mean, it was a part of it, and the trope of it was there, but it wasn't as anything near what it is now and how central her character, Claire Nyas, who plays Melissa, like nothing like how that is. All those things were definitely added later. So even the stuff between Dreyfus, I was saying this in another interview, the stuff between Dreyfus and Paul Sloan, like in the park and all those things, that was like me going, guys, let's run around the corner and grab this improv pickup flashback sequences where we can just delve deeper into this part of him as a father. He's just not a good dad, and he thinks he is. He's trying to do the good thing, but he's just not a good dad.
That's it. It sounds
great,
like
soldier, bad dad. And that's right. An interesting character, right?
Yeah. That sounds like something that I don't hear about often in a movie like this, which is almost sheer action drama type of thing. I don't ever hear about, let's go do some improv somewhere for a scene for this movie. That's pretty unusual, right?
I that's kind of how I roll. So I don't know. I wouldn't know any other way, but I mean, I kind of do. I always say that, you know, we have this saying, like when me and my DP step on set, you know, we're like, look, I don't know if you remember Back to the Future. You're like, when Marty McFly is about to play the rock and roll song, he's like, this is a blues riff and B, guys. Watch for the changes and try to keep up, right? And it's kind of like, that's kind of what indie films are. You're playing jazz with a lot of things. And if you can take that and make that your kind of mantra in a way, you allow so many new things to kind of come into where it wasn't before, you know?
Yeah. So. Do you care to get into the what the script was originally, since it didn't have the daughter element really much?
It was in there, but it was literally like, I could tell you, it was almost as if somebody took the script for Rambo First Blood and just changed the character names, and that was it.
Oh, really? Because that's where you sort of get that element
there. The movie was called Hunter originally. I was like, guys, I can't do that. That's So there was a lot. So there's a lot of things. It was like, but again, they were very cool, and the company was great, and they trusted me with it, which I'm very, very appreciative of, and I'm really proud of this movie. So I mean, I think, you know, all the right decisions were made that we, you know, that we kind of elevated what would have just been a standard shoot 'em up that we've seen 1,001 times.
Right. Obviously, I would like to get into your casting. You have I was not familiar with Paul Sloan, but he's been in a lot of your movies, apparently. So you guys apparently get along really well. So tell me what it's like to have that kind of relationship with a guy like that.
Look, I mean, it's great. It's one of those things we met. We had a mutual manager years and years ago, and we've literally been basically like best friends since. I mean, for over a decade, and just like not just like personal best friends, but also really great collaborators between this. And I mean, he's been a bunch of stuff that we've done. Night Crew, which is great. Vigilante Diaries, which was amazing. That's his movie. And then now this is his other like Paul Sloan movie, you know? So it's always great. And it's the dream when you're able to work with your friends and make movies. I mean, that's definitely the dream for sure. So I just imagine you guys going off to make a movie together. It's like that. So.
He looks like, I don't know, man. He is, he really does look the part in this.
You mean that? Oh, I'll tell you how he really is. Is you yell cut and he's like, oh dude, let's go watch. I got to go to the comic book store and like hang with my cats.
No and, way.
Oh my God.
It would be like Chris and I doing a movie together.
Exactly. It would be very much like that. Yes.
No, man. Paul is the biggest comic book nerd movie guy. Like that's, we're just all big. He just looks like Leonidas, but he's really like Kevin Smith.
I mean, gosh, what an absolute brute of a man this guy is, man. Oh my God.
Brute of a man. He's just petting his cats and reading comic books.
He's the male Rosario Dawson because you know, she's a huge comic book person.
Yes. Obviously, you have a lot of well known. I mean, Richard Dreyfuss is in this. Michael Madsen, Taryn Manning, Jake Weber. All these are solid people. So tell me how you got them in the movie and what it was like to work with.
Well, I mean, Taryn's a friend, so, and she now lives in Palm Springs, and that's where I'm based out of, and that's basically where we shot this movie, the Palm Springs area. This is all shot in my backyard, which made it so easy to do, and that's why we're able to do the things that we did so easily during COVID. I mean, during the height of COVID, the second shutdown, So Taryn was a friend, and I was like, hey, I'm making this crazy movie. You want to do it? And she's like, yeah, let's have fun. And it was the first time we worked together. And then Mike Hatton, the producer, was able to bring on Jake Weber and Dreyfuss, who really just brought that heavy, great acting chops to it.
Right.
So they're just always great. And Jake is always just so understated in the movie until he's not, he's just an incredible, incredible actor. And I think that this movie really works because he really brings it. So yeah, they're just all great. I couldn't be happy with such a, for such a cast for sure.
I was actually rewatching the Zack Snyder remake of Dawn of the Dead the other day, and I had forgotten Weber was in that. I was like, God, I haven't seen Jake Weber in a minute. And that was really cool to pop this on and see.
Right. You're like, Jake Weber.
Richard Dreyfuss, like, I guess I don't know. Is he a fixer? Is that what we're going to call him? I'm not, but I love that. Just, he's about to be 74. I looked it up.
Oh, you mean Dreyfuss? Dreyfuss?
Yeah. Yeah. And I just thought he was like, man, that guy still got it. I mean, he comes into that town with all those people and just, takes over the situation. You totally buy it 100% that, like, why wouldn't you drop everything and listen to Richard Dreyfuss tell you what to do?
Right. Exactly. And that's basically the character he was playing. And like I said, remember when I said that in the original script, that was a total Rambo ripoff, that the Troutman character comes in. That's very much who Richard Dreyfuss is in this one, but we changed it.
Yeah, no, you did, because you really don't know until the end, really, who he's even
whose side he's on.
Yeah,
yeah. You mentioned that you shot this around Palm Springs. This is set in California, though, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. That area that you shoot it in, especially the part where Jake's getting lost in the woods or whatever. It's like, I guess it's a bunch of palm trees all in a row, like in this huge, like, I guess that's what it is, right? A bunch of palm trees sort of like all in a big, huge cluster of some sort.
Yeah. I mean, out here there's miles of agriculture. I mean, the Coachella Valley is an agricultural, that's the basic number one money maker out here in the Coachella Valley. So out in the East Valley is what we call it, near Salton Sea, there's just acreage. I mean, miles and miles of date fields and palm trees and different things. And so when this, again, the script originally was set out in the woods and all this kind of other thing, again, very much like First Blood. Mm-hmm. So when they were like hitting me up about shooting it locally here, I was like, well, look, I have miles of rows of trees that this character could just get lost in, and that he could take off from where he was at the Jake Weber and Taryn Manning's estate and just gets lost out in these trees. It really is a giant maze out there for miles.
Yeah,
so I was like, that's narratively, that's how we kind of adjusted it. So yeah.
Yeah, that's a that's always a fun shot when you have that overhead of all of those trees and everything.
Just right. Totally.
Just miles of them and everything. And like, how are they going to find this guy in the middle of all of this? And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And not really a part of California. I feel like you see that much in movies, right? I mean, that's
no, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where people are like, "Where are you, Cambodia?" Yeah. I'm like, "You're just basically in the back, you know, the back fields here." But
I'm
it's just
I'm down
it's,
the street
it's
from
almost
you.
Like imagine like a corn maze, you know, or like a field of corn. And you're just miles of it out there. You know, you just get out there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yeah. What was your toughest day on set?
Ooh, let me think. You know, this shoot was pretty great. I mean, we were coming off of a very tough shoot before that, months before that on when we did Take Back. But I think, you know what? The shoot went fairly, very smooth on this one. It was really great. You know, we had gotten in the groove with how to deal with COVID and COVID protocols. The cast mm-hmm. was great. There was no problems. Nobody was a pain in the ass. It was really a really great shoot. We really had fun on this one.
Oh, come on. Jake Weber was probably just being a diva on set. We all know.
No, man.
Was,
I would love to tell you stories. Nobody was a diva. Everybody. I was the biggest diva on this movie.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No, it was good. It was really a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I had some good stories for you. Like Paul Sloan didn't get out of his trailer until we gave him like green M&Ms and a Red Bull, but nope, it wasn't like that.
You have that Island of Dr. Moreau stuff, yeah, oh you know, God. That's so juicy.
No,
you
for know. Sure.
Any of these experienced actors help you learn anything about filmmaking during this? Like, you know, you got Dreyfuss, you got Madsen, you got people who've been around forever.
I don't know if it was definitely any about the filmmaking process. I think Dreyfuss just always puts on a masterclass on the acting side.
Mm-hmm.
On that side. I mean, you know, when it comes to the technical side of filmmaking, I don't think there was anything like that, but I think it was just, With Dreyfuss, you're dealing with Jake and Dreyfuss are both very, very hardcore thespians, you know, like they really mm-hmm. were delving deep into their characters and stuff like that. But I don't know. I think really the best parts were Dreyfuss's stories on Jaws and Close Encounters and stuff like that. I could just sit there for hours and listen to him ramble on about all that. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, one thing I'm just fascinated by the a lot of these the working on a pretty big or just working on an action movie with a, you know, an independent action movie.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about the like, do you feel like that makes you a little more creative with what you're doing? I mean, are you limited with like, I don't know, like you only have so many gunshots you can pull off that day or blood, you know?
Well, I don't know if that makes sense. All those gunshots are VFX, right? So
yeah.
we weren't able to shoot blanks on those days and things like that. But I don't know. I think the most part here was action aside, it was really coming up with ideas and inspirations to keep the drama going with the family mm-hmm. and the daughter and Dreyfuss and Paul's characters. Those kind of were where we really changed up a lot. That's what really evolved in this script more than anything else. Because the action beats were similarly the action beats, but really just like changing a lot of things of, you know, Taryn and Jake's character and the deal that they were trying to, you know, they were trying to do with the water deal and all these other things. It just kind of made it try to be a little bit more interesting than just, you know, bad guys, bad sheriff, money, or what have you. So
water, I mean, I guess you are in the desert. So I guess water really is a big, big deal out there, right?
It's more big of a deal than oil out here for sure. I mean, out in California too. I mean, especially now in a drought. This, that, and the other. I mean, that water is just becoming the biggest commodity, period out. I mean, just in the world, clean water, that kind of stuff. So when we were trying to come up with this idea of what's really important and what kind of deals like with the government, and, you know, and Jake Weber having the security company that keeps the corporate interests of the senator and all these deals kind of things, this little bit of Chinatown-esque kind of things.
Yeah.
You know, Water seemed to be the better play that was a little obscure, but especially out in the desert, you know, I think it's apropos of how that connects to the story enough for us to just keep driving towards the end, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they were just trying to cover stuff up. You know, these guys are trying to cover it up. And, you know, Jake's daughter could derail that with press and the law and government and stuff like that.
Well, you know, it's kind of one of those things, like you watch like Batman Returns and like that's, you know, Christopher Walken, that's like what he wants. You know, he's trying to control the water. And it seems so silly there. But like when you're watching Chinatown or this, you know, it's real. Like, no, that actually makes sense. Like that would be. That makes more sense than a lot of plots they have in like California crime films. Also, I wanted to ask the Taryn Manning and the Jake Weber characters. I thought it was cool that you made them brother and sister.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, a couple or whatever. He's a henchman or however you would do it. Was that always the plan, or did it go through some different iterations?
Yeah. No, the brother and sister, we creatively battled about that a little bit. And I really was adamant about having that sibling relationship and the son be this kind of fuck up character son that just was the loser kid that was always a pain in their asses. And originally I believe that the Taryn Manning character was like an old lady that kind of stuff. So it was too Ozarky for me. And it was, I definitely wanted to play it definitely more Cersei, Jaime Lannister, Shakespearean kind of,
kind
of vibe where you're really hinting at this incestuous, weird relationship without going all the way there.
I'm glad that you brought that up because I was like, man, if I ask this question, you're either going to hate me.
No, or, totally on purpose.
Or you're going to be like, oh, totally. That's what, you know, because there is that, is that sort of like, glad, are they?
I'm glad you guys got it. That's totally weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Are they like doing it? You know, that's sort of what you're going for in this thing. And it's like, and I actually had forgotten that they weren't brother and sister in a couple of moments. Right. So.
And you're like, which brings us back. It constantly keeps it interesting and weird and keeps the audience guessing. And then also, I always feel this reinforces the drama of like, well, yeah, they're just twisted, sick people.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to do this kind of stuff. They are going to murder this girl. They are going to just cover things up because they're just twisted already.
Yeah, for sure. I was actually trying to think of who commits the biggest sin in this movie. And
who do you think? I know who I think.
Well, I think it's the cop, but the guy who gets, I don't want to spoil the movie, but it's not, I don't think it's one of the main characters.
Okay.
I think the guy, there's a moment in there where, you know, but do you have different thoughts on who that is?
I want to hear Jonathan's thought now. So
I would say, yeah, the Brian Hayes Curie character is probably who I'm leaning towards.
Oh, interesting. All right. Okay, good. I like it. I like hearing other people's take on it. Because in my opinion, and the way I thought it and wrote it and tried to shoot it, was the person who commits the biggest sin in this is Paul Sloan.
Huh. I think that's what's interesting about this movie. Right.
But that's what's interesting, that I think Jake Hunter is the cause of it all.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that would be the core.
If he had, it's one of those things where it's those, like, you go back as a parent. I don't know if you guys are parents. If you go back or whatever, and you go, if I had done this, would this have happened?
Oh no. Yeah, no. I've got a little. So girl.
It's that kind of stuff. If you go down the rabbit hole, you know, and you go towards a sequence of events, what happens with our choices? You know, none of this would have ever happened. But
that's true. She wouldn't even be at that party, is what you're saying. No, that's totally true. She wouldn't even have
needed to fill the hole and void in her life.
Right.
It was that kind of stuff. But on the surface, yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I think Brian, It's the kid. I mean, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. So, but I always try to bring it back to Jake Hunter.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. That's the kind of cool thing about this is that you can watch this straightforward and say, oh yeah, Paul Sloan, he's kicking so much ass. He's amazing. And then by the end of it, be very satisfied by.
Right. Well, I'm glad you guys think so. Cause you know, we try to do it that way. I think, you know, I try to really end strong with this one with, you know, the cathartic moment and then we really finally see what happened.
Right. But you can also sit there and go, well, of all the people we're being told are the bad guys in this situation, you know, who is more responsible for any of this going on and everything? And I think that's the most interesting dynamic of this movie.
Well, I'm glad you do. Cause we really tried to do that. Cause if not, we wouldn't like the fact that everybody's asking questions is great. Like that's a great, great thing because if not, you would just sit there and some guys shoot guns and some guys get killed and that's it. End of the story.
You'll hear people sometimes, you know, like you'll see like reviews of movies sometimes where it's like people are like, I don't have anyone to root for. And I'm just always like, have you ever seen film noir? Like, I mean, and it's not even so much, I guess what most people mean by that is there's not like a 100% hero, right? Like, I love where everybody's flawed and you've kind of got to, you know, take what you can from each character and root for that, I guess, you know, root that they get better, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think so.
Yeah. Talk about some of your action scenes here, especially the one towards the end when Jake is going towards the police station and he has to deal with a whole bunch of people and everything. What is it like, creating one of those scenes and tell us what your thought process is going, into staging action like that?
Well, really it's a two-man process. Most of the time it's myself and my DP going, all right, cool. How do we make this look as big and cool as possible? And, you know, tactically as cool and makes any type of sense as possible. Why he goes back in there, what he's trying to do, what's the cat and mouse game he's trying to, is he luring them out? Is he just trying to go on this bloodlust mission of revenge? What's the point here? And then obviously staging, you know, a shootout in the middle of a plaza, which is pretty crazy. And, you know, just a bunch of guys running around the middle of the city, which was really fun. I think it's just that. I think it was a very straightforward shootout where you had two sides. He comes in and breaks off and then is able to get away. Without the support of, you know, my city out here, my backyard, I don't think we would have been able to cover so much ground and territory and stage it as big as we can on this kind of indie scale.
Yeah, I always am fascinated how the action scene comes together because, you know, I think sometimes you got people who are like, well, I'm going to shoot, you know, a million feet of footage and then I'm going to just edit it as fast as I can in the editing room. And then, you know, then you have others who are like really like looking into, you know, how they're going to stage their scenes and everything. So I'm always interested in those questions.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it starts with the location and, you know, what are we trying to do and how can we, again, build the scope of it? Cause again, like I said before in other interviews, like we shot this during the height of the second shutdown of COVID out here. And everybody that I know was making COVID movies or like one room movies and this, that.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to make just a regular movie. So that was always a challenge. So I think the ending is just kind of a great kind of shoot 'em up that leads us to our finale.
The image in this movie that I can't get out of my head is it's in the trailer if anybody wants to watch the trailer, but Richard Dreyfuss shooting a gun into a car and just blasting away. It is such a, I don't know, there's a satisfying resonance to that. I don't know if it's just the actor or if it's just the presentation or if it's a lot of those things, but Did is that something that you look at in the camera and going, just yes, this is what, you know, are you just like celebrating when you see
there's there's a great story behind that, because that was definitely a caveat of Dreyfus's when he signed up.
He goes,
I've never shot a gun on screen.
I was about to say, I feel like I've never seen him shoot anything before.
Yeah, like what? Maybe one other film. One other film. It was some other movie. I forget. He says he shot, but not. He says it's never. He never gets to do that, right? So, well, on top of it, he really just hated the Jake Weber, Taron Manning characters. Like he hated them. Like, right. he was like, I gotta kill him. That was his biggest thing when he signed on. He was like, it's cool. I want to do this, but I have to kill these people. And we were like, really? And we were like, because when I rewrote it, Paul Sloan kills them. And I was like, and that was the end. And he was like, no, I got to kill them. And we all looked at each other, like Mike Hatton and myself and Paul, we look at each other. We're like, man, if Richard Dreyfus comes out with a machine gun and blows people away, people are going to shit their pants. That'll be so crazy. And so we went down the rabbit hole of that. And when we shot the scene, interestingly enough, we did it with him. And then we did it with Paul Sloan doing it.
So we have interesting.
We have two versions of this, right? Because I wasn't quite sure what was going to work. Cause I didn't want to take that ending away from Paul. But then in the editing process, I felt what was more important was his finale with his daughter, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of, we don't know if he's dead. We don't know if he's alive. We don't know if he died. And that's his last vision of it. And it really became clear the showstopper was going to be putting Dreyfus right before the title comes up. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
and it feels that way. Everybody who's seen it is like, great ending, and then what a great button.
Yeah. I'm sitting there thinking of, like, you know, if you're in Jake Weber and Taron Manning's shoes in that scene where the cop that's driving you down the road just stops and then gets out and then just kind of like, I don't know, looks like he's about to go take a leak or something or whatever, right, while this other car is blocking the road. It's a great setup. Like it's almost like their horror movie coming to life in that, you know. So it's one of those, it's a fun sort of staging of a, you know, of the characters, like, you know, final moments or whatever. So
right, because you think they're gonna get away, right?
Mm-hmm.
You think all they did was get off the hook, they get arrested, they get taken off, and you're like, wow, that sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, especially.
Oh, no.
Right. Well, especially since we've been told time and again through this movie, they run that town. They don't, right. You know, so it's a natural expectation that that's going to happen. So.
Right. And look, yeah. It can't be that title. It can't be every last one of them.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, exactly.
True. It's in the
title. I mean, I definitely would have been like, wait a minute, why is it called that again?
At the end, you'd have been like, almost all of them?
Right, right.
You're like, that would have been the YouTube, the internet comments, almost all of them.
Like, it becomes a completely different movie. You're making a comedy at that
point. It's like people telling me they figured out the twist of Malignant, and I'm always like, well, it's called Malignant, so I don't, you know.
Right.
I feel like you should know that's what's going to happen, you know.
Right. Jonathan, do you have anything else? We'll probably have to wrap this up.
Yeah, we're getting close. No, I got my questions in, so it was really fun talking to you, man. Do you have anything coming up you want to discuss?
Yeah, look, Dreyfus and I just did another movie.
Wow, awesome.
Abandonment. It's a thriller. We shot in Alabama, and then that was in September, and then I just got done. I just wrapped last night my new big action picture called Section 8, which I'm sure you guys will hear about. It has a who's who of action stars, and it's pretty bananas. I mean, it's definitely a next level career thing. So it's going
to really
It's going to be pretty crazy. Big, gigantic action, amazing actors. and excited to really keep going with the drama because it's very much in the vein of every last one of them, except on steroids, I guess.
Right. It sounds like you are one of those who's got a movie coming out, a movie you're making, and another movie you're editing all at once.
I'll be editing 3 movies in a month. So I leave for another movie on Friday. So,
oh my God,
it's good. It's good. It's all good problems to have. So it's great.
Okay. The movie is called Every Last One of Them. It comes out in theaters on demand and digital on October 22nd. We'd like to thank Christian Sesma for giving us his time. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.